MSW Media. Thanks to Hunter Douglas for supporting Daily Beans. Hunter Douglas makes innovative window shade designs, gorgeous fabrics, and control systems that can be scheduled to automatically adjust to their optimal position throughout the day and bring greater convenience, style, and comfort to your home. Go to HunterDouglas.com/DailyBeans today to get your free Style Gets Smarter design guide with fresh takes, creative ideas, and smart solutions for dressing your windows. News with Daily Beans, Daily Beans, Daily Beans, Daily Beans. Hello and welcome to the Daily Beans for Tuesday, March 29th, 2022. A very special Daily Beans. We have Judge Carter's findings on the in-camera review of the 111 John Eastman emails he claims were privileged. So sit back, grab a cup of coffee, and allow me to go through this decision with you in detail. I'm your host, Allison Gill. Hi, everyone. Happy Tuesday. Big news. And I can't stress this enough. This is probably one of the most consequential court filings I've ever read. And I'm going to go over it with you in detail because I know y'all have been on the Eastman train with me for a while because I've seen this as one of the biggest cases in the 1-6 investigation because it could lead to Department of Justice criminal referrals and indictments for Donald and John Eastman. The other big case is the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys conspiracy with Donald to physically obstruct the electoral count by force, which is seditious conspiracy. I've been saying we can get Trump on 1512C2, obstructing an official proceeding, because it's easier to prove than seditious conspiracy, and it carries the same sentence. But when Garland shocked us all by charging the Oath Keepers with seditious conspiracy, and then connected the actions of Enrique Tarrio to Donald Trump, DOJ could shock the shit out of me again with a seditious conspiracy charge against Trump himself, but we'll see. But what I'm going to go over today is the plot to overturn the election by pressuring Pence to throw out electors in 7 states, and how Eastman's emails relate to that conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding and defraud the United States of America. But before I get to the filing, there's a couple of headlines I should mention. First, Russian billionaire Roman Abramovich suffered symptoms of suspected poisoning at talks in Kyiv earlier this month, and that's according to sources close to him. This is the Chelsea football club owner who has now recovered, but he reportedly suffered sore eyes and skin peeling. 2 Ukrainian peace negotiators were also said to have been affected. The Wall Street Journal reported claims the alleged poisoning was orchestrated by hardliners in Russia who wanted to sabotage the talks. The conditions of Mr. Abramovich and the Ukrainian negotiators, who included Ukrainian MP Rustem Umerov, have improved since the incident on March 3rd, and that's according to the paper-quoted sources. And a source close to Mr. Abramovich told the BBC he had suffered symptoms of suspected poisoning. They said he has now recovered and was continuing negotiations to try and end the war with Ukraine. And on Sunday, President Zelensky said Mr. Abramovich had offered him help to de-escalate Russia's invasion of the country. The Russian billionaire traveled between Moscow and Kyiv for several rounds of talks at the start of the month. He reportedly met President Volodymyr Zelensky during the trip, but the Ukrainian leader was not affected, and his spokesman had no information about the incident. Also in the news today, Lisa Monaco of the DOJ has reaffirmed the department's commitment to prosecuting 1-6 cases at any level and has announced that they're adding 131 new attorneys to work on the Capitol attack investigation, which is good. I've been asking for more resources, and here now we have them. And according to a newly publicized internal audit, FBI agents violated agency rules at least 747 times in 18 months while conducting investigations involving political candidates, public officials, religious and political groups, and other sensitive matters. U.S. Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, the ranking member, today requested information and an independent inspector general review following a newly publicized 2019 FBI audit that revealed widespread violations of internal FBI policies governing investigations of political candidates, public officials, religious and political groups, and other sensitive matters. As reported by the Washington Times, the internal review revealed a ratio of slightly more than 2 rule violations per sensitive investigative matter reviewed by FBI auditors, including agents' failure to obtain approval from senior FBI officials to start an investigation, failure to conduct a necessary legal review before opening investigations, and failure to tell prosecutors what they were doing. In light of these new revelations, the senators sent letters to Chris Wray and the OIG at the Department of Justice to request an independent review of the FBI's widespread violations of its domestic investigations and operations guide. The letter to Wray In that letter, the senators requested an unredacted copy of the 2019 audit and a detailed explanation of what remedies, if any, the FBI has taken in response to its findings. All right, with those headlines out of the way, let's take a quick break. I'll be right back with a rundown of the Eastman ruling. Stay with us.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Hey, everybody, it's AG for The Beans, and today's show is brought to you by Helix Sleep. We all know how difficult it is to function without proper sleep. Our health and well-being depend on us getting quality and quantity sleep, right? It has to be good. And Nick, you can't wake up 10 times a night, because I used to struggle with that, and I would struggle to fall asleep. Or, you know, like I said, toss and turn, get night sweats. And in the beginning, I thought it was stress, and that was part of it. But in reality, I had a mattress made for someone else. And after switching to Helix, I've been sleeping better than ever. Whatever your sleep style or body type, Helix has the right mattress for you. And you can take Helix's online sleep quiz to determine which mattress is best at helixsleep.com/dailybeans. And you can choose from a variety of mattresses, whether they're soft or firm, whether they regulate your body temperature or align your spine. There's even a Helix Plus mattress for plus-size sleepers. The Helix Midnight Bed is exactly what I was looking for because I'm a side sleeper who prefers a medium firm mattress, and now I'm able to fall asleep easily. I sleep throughout the night. I wake up feeling refreshed and alert. Helix has over 12,000 five-star reviews. They were awarded number one best overall mattress pick of 2020 by GQ and Wired Magazine. Leading chiropractors and doctors of sleep medicine recommend Helix to improve your sleep. Helix has a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it out for 100 nights risk-free. They have financing options available. If you don't love it, they'll come and pick it up and refund your money. And Helix right now is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and two free pillows for listeners at helixsleep.com/dailybeans. That's Helix Sleep, helixsleep.com/dailybeans for up to $200 off all mattress orders and two free pillows. All right, everybody, let's hit the hot notes.
Hot notes.
All right, everybody, let's go over this filing. And it's raining a little bit, so if you hear some raindrops on the top of my studio, that's what that is. But I want to break down this ruling for you. It's a 44-page ruling. And I love the order in which the court runs these emails through those seven privilege considerations that were raised by the committee that I've gone over with you over and over again. And they do it like they're running water through seven different filters. So if you'll remember from the committee filing, those seven privilege busters were no signed engagement letter, a substantial need by the committee, crime fraud exception, common law fraud, the Chapman server problem. They talked about it publicly, and Eastman failed to meet the burden of the work product doctrine. Now, the judge runs these 111 emails through each of those filters. And first, the court finds that even absent a signed agreement, that Eastman was representing Trump. He was. It was obvious. And that's a good call. And you'd want the same consideration if it were you. And the court also finds that just because the emails are on the Chapman server, the client, whoever Eastman's talking to, still has an expectation of privilege. So the Chapman thing doesn't waive privilege. And I like that, too. Like, imagine if you were emailing with your lawyer who worked at Chapman. And you had no idea that you don't have an expectation of privacy. That would suck for you, the client. I hadn't thought about it from that angle. So when we look at the work product doctrine filter, though, and then we look at whether any of those 111 emails were in anticipation of litigation, all but 15 make it out of this one alive. 96 of these emails are found to not be in anticipation of litigation and must be handed over, and the court breaks them down into groups. 10 are just bullshit emails, no content, just a signature line or a logo, shit like that. Not privileged. Hand them over. 22 relate to pressuring Pence. 21 of those are not in anticipation of litigation, but there's one that is, and put a pin in that one because we'll run it through a few more filters later and hand over the other 21. 19 are related to pressuring state officials and legislators, and all 19 of those have to be handed over. 17 were emails to Congress, including a memo to seven specific senators to pressure them to throw out electors. All 17 of those have to be handed over. 20 are connected to third parties and have to be handed over because of that third-party privilege waiver. 9 are news articles and press releases. Those are public, so you can hand those over. And so the work product burden filter chewed up 96 emails that Eastman has to hand over. They're not in anticipation of litigation. And that leaves 15 emails that were prepared in anticipation of litigation and can't be ordered handed over on the work product doctrine, right? And so that's 14 plus that one Pence email. So those are considered work product in anticipation of litigation. So the court is going to look at some other filters. The third parties one says that your shit has to be prepared by an agent of the client. And the court finds that two were not prepared by or for any agent of Trump. So those two have to be handed over. We're down to 13. Quote, the court now considers whether Dr. Eastman waived his privilege over any of the 13 remaining documents that the court concluded above were protected by work product. The court finds two were shared with the public. So that waives privilege. So those two, they go. With 11 emails left, the court considers the crime fraud exception and common law fraud. First, the court finds none of the 11 are caught up in the common law fraud filter because none of these emails have to do with the big lie, the fraud. Now the court addresses whether crime fraud would apply to the 11 emails by determining first whether it's more likely than not that Eastman and Trump committed crimes. So they're going to check that out first, and then they're going to determine whether any of those 11 emails were in furtherance of those crimes. So the court here doesn't just look at the emails to see if they're crimey. The court actually makes a determination as to whether a crime was committed and then determines whether the emails were in furtherance of it because all of the evidence is publicly available. And they start with 1512C2. The Select Committee alleges that President Trump violated 18 U.S. Code Section 1512C2, which criminalizes obstruction or attempted obstruction of an official proceeding. It requires three elements: the person obstructed, influenced, or impeded, or attempted to obstruct, influence, or impede an official proceeding in the United States, and did so corruptly. Attempts to obstruct Section 1512C2 requires that the obstructive conduct have a nexus to a specific official proceeding that was either pending or was reasonably foreseeable to the person when he engaged in the conduct. President Trump attempted to obstruct an official proceeding by launching a pressure campaign to convince Vice President Pence to disrupt the joint session of Congress on January 6th. President Trump facilitated two meetings in the days before January 6th that were explicitly tied to persuading Pence to disrupt the joint session of Congress. On January 4th, Trump and Dr. Eastman hosted a meeting in the Oval Office with Vice President Pence, the Vice President's counsel, Greg Jacob, and the Vice President's chief of staff, Mark Short. At that meeting, Dr. Eastman presented his plan to Vice President Pence, focusing on either rejecting electors or delaying the count. When Vice President Pence was unpersuaded, President Trump sent Dr. Eastman to review the plan in depth with the Vice President's counsel the next day, January 5th. Pence's counsel interpreted Dr. Eastman's presentation as being on behalf of the president. He said that in his deposition. On the morning of January 6th, Trump made several last-minute revised appeals to the vice president to pressure him to carry out the plan. At 1 a.m., Trump tweeted, "If Vice President Mike Pence comes through for us, we will win the presidency. Mike can send it back." At 8:17 a.m., Trump tweeted, "All Mike Pence has to do is send them back to the states, and we win. Do it, Mike. This is a time for extreme courage." Shortly after, President Trump rang Vice President Pence and once again urged him to make the call and enact the plan. Just before the joint session of Congress began, Trump gave a speech to a large crowd at the Ellipse in which he warned, quote, "And Mike Pence, I hope you're going to stand up for the good of our Constitution and the good of our country. And if you're not, I'm going to be very disappointed in you. I will tell you right now." President Trump ended his speech by galvanizing the crowd to join him in enacting the plan. "Let's walk down Pennsylvania Avenue to give Vice President Pence and Congress the kind of pride and boldness they need to take back our country." Together, these actions, more likely than not, constitute attempts to obstruct an official proceeding. So then the court addresses the idea of an official proceeding, and they go, yeah, this was an official proceeding. 10 other judges have said so. We join their well-reasoned opinion. Then they address corrupt intent, and this is important. We have talked about this being too dumb to crime. Did he actually know he lost? A person violates 1512C when they obstruct an official proceeding with corrupt intent. The Ninth Circuit has not defined corruptly for purposes of this statute. However, the court has made clear that the threshold for acting corruptly is lower than consciousness of wrongdoing, meaning a person does not need to know their actions are wrong to break the law. Because President Trump likely knew that the plan to disrupt the electoral count was wrongful, his mindset exceeds the threshold for acting corruptly under 1512C. President Trump and Dr. Eastman justified the plan with allegations of election fraud, but President Trump likely knew his justification was baseless, and therefore the entire plan was unlawful. Although Dr. Eastman argues that President Trump was advised that several state elections were fraudulent, the Select Committee points to numerous executive branch officials who publicly stated and privately stressed to President Trump that there was no evidence of fraud. By early January, more than 60 courts dismissed cases alleging fraud due to lack of standing or lack of evidence, noting they made strained legal arguments without merit and speculative accusations, and that there is no evidence to support the accusations of voter fraud. Trump's repeated pleas for Georgia Secretary of State Raffensperger clearly demonstrate that his justification was not to investigate fraud, but to win the election. Quote, "So what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes, fellas. I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break." Unquote. Taken together, this evidence demonstrates that President Trump likely knew the Electoral Count plan had no factual justification. It goes on to say here, the plan not only lacked factual basis, but also legal justification. Dr. Eastman's memo noted the plan was bold, certainly. The memo declared Dr. Eastman's intent to step outside the bounds of normal legal practice, quote, "We're no longer playing by Queensbury rules," unquote. In addition, Pence very consistently made clear to Trump that the plan was unlawful, refusing many times to unilaterally reject electors or return them to the states. In the meeting in the Oval Office just 2 days before January 6th, Pence stressed his immediate instinct is that there's no way one person could be entrusted by the framers to exercise that authority. Dr. Eastman argues the plan was legally justified because it was, quote, "grounded on a good faith interpretation of the Constitution." But, quote, "ignorance of the law is no excuse, and believing the Electoral Count Act is unconstitutional does not give President Trump license to violate it. Disagreeing with the law entitles President Trump to seek a remedy in court, not to disrupt a constitutionally mandated process. And President Trump knew how to pursue election claims in court after filing and losing more than 60 suits. This plan was a last-ditch attempt to secure the presidency by any means." I love that. Dude, you can't just break a law. You have to file about it in court. And we know you know how to file lawsuits because you filed 60 and you lost them all, but you know how to file them. The illegality of the plan was obvious, the judge says. Our nation was founded on the peaceful transition of power, epitomized by George Washington laying down his sword to make way for democratic elections. Ignoring this history, President Trump vigorously campaigned for the vice president to single-handedly determine the results of the election. As Vice President Pence stated, quote, "No vice president in American history has ever asserted such authority. Every American, and certainly the president of the United States, knows that in a democracy, leaders are elected, not installed." With a plan this, quote-unquote, bold, President Trump knowingly tried to subvert this fundamental principle. Based on the evidence, the court finds it is more likely than not that President Trump corruptly attempted to obstruct the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021. Whew. Strong words. Trump, by the way, not Eastman. Trump. All right, let's take a quick break here. I'll be right back with conspiracy to defraud the United States. You don't want to miss this. Stick around. Hi, everyone. Today's show is presented by Hunter Douglas, maker of elegant window shade designs, beautiful fabrics, and automated control systems that can automatically adjust to their ideal position throughout the day. With Hunter Douglas's PowerView technology, you can program shades to automatically adjust for the perfect balance of light, privacy, and insulation, no matter what time of day it is. Hunter Douglas shades diffuse harsh sunlight for an even, beautiful glow in your room. They protect your privacy, so you can see out, but people can't see in. And they help save you money by staying warmer in the winter and cooler in the summer, and easing the burden on our power grid. As a result, your home will be more functional, stylish, beautiful, comfortable, warm. And in my opinion, PowerView's best feature is how it automatically adjusts your shades, so you have the perfect balance of light, privacy, and insulation no matter what time of day it is. I highly recommend checking out Hunter Douglas. I love their stuff. Just go to hunterdouglas.com/dailybeans today. And they'll send you a Style Gets Smarter design guide with fresh takes, creative ideas, and smart solutions for dressing your windows. That's hunterdouglas.com/dailybeans for your free design guide. All right, welcome back. Next up, conspiracy to defraud the United States. And I'm quoting here. I'm reading from the ruling. The Select Committee also alleges President Trump, Dr. Eastman, and others conspired to defraud the United States by disrupting the electoral count in violation of 18 U.S. Code 371. That crime requires that, first of all, at least two people enter into an agreement to obstruct a lawful function of government, and two, by deceitful or dishonest means, and three, that a member of the conspiracy engaged in at least one overt act in furtherance of the agreement. So let's cover agreement to obstruct a lawful government function first. As the court discusses at length above, the evidence demonstrates that Trump likely attempted to obstruct the joint session of Congress. While the court earlier analyzed those actions as attempts to obstruct an official proceeding, Congress convening to count electoral votes is also a lawful function of government within the meaning of 18 U.S. Code 371, which Dr. Eastman does not dispute. An agreement between co-conspirators need not be express and can be inferred from the conspirators' conduct. There is a strong set of circumstantial evidence showing that there was likely an agreement between President Trump and Dr. Eastman to enact the plan articulated in Eastman's memo. In the days leading up to January 6th, Eastman and Trump had two meetings with high-ranking officials to advance the plan. On January 4th, Trump and Dr. Eastman hosted a meeting in the Oval Office to persuade Pence to carry out the plan. The next day, Trump sent Dr. Eastman to continue to persuade Vice President Pence's staff, in which Vice President Pence's counsel perceived Dr. Eastman as acting as the president's representative. Leading small meetings in the heart of the White House implies an agreement between the president and Dr. Eastman and a shared goal of advancing that electoral count plan. The strength of this agreement is evident from President Trump's praise for Dr. Eastman and his plan in the January 6th speech on the Ellipse. Quote, John is one of the most brilliant lawyers in the country. And he looked at this and said, what an absolute disgrace that this can happen to our Constitution. Based on these repeated meetings and statements, the evidence shows that an agreement to enact the electoral count plan likely existed between Trump and Eastman. Next, deceitful or dishonest means is a part of this, is one of the elements. And the judge says obstruction of a lawful government function violates 371 when it's carried out by deceit, craft, or trickery, or at least by means that are dishonest, unquote. While acting on a good faith misunderstanding of the law is not dishonest, merely disagreeing with the law does not constitute a good faith misunderstanding, because all persons have a duty to obey the law, whether they agree with it or not. The court discusses above how the evidence shows that Trump likely knew the electoral count plan was illegal. President Trump continued to push the plan despite being aware of its illegality, constituted obstruction by dishonest means under 371. The evidence also demonstrates Dr. Eastman likely knew the plan was unlawful. Eastman heard from numerous mentors and like-minded colleagues that his plan had no basis in history or precedent. Fourth Circuit Judge Luttig, for whom Dr. Eastman clerked, publicly stated the plan's analysis was incorrect at every turn. Vice President Pence's legal counsel spent hours refuting each part of the plan to Dr. Eastman, including noting there had never been a departure from the Electoral Count Act, and that not a single one of the framers would agree with his position. Dr. Eastman repeatedly recognized that his plan had no legal support either. In his discussion with Pence and Pence's counsel, Dr. Eastman acknowledged the, quote, 100% consistent historical practice since the time of the founding that the vice president did not have the authority to act as the memo proposed. More importantly, Dr. Eastman admitted more than once his proposal violated several provisions of statutory law, including explicitly characterizing a plan as one more relatively minor violation of the Electoral Count Act. That's that smoking gun email we talked about. In addition, on January 5th, Dr. Eastman conceded that the Supreme Court would unanimously reject his plan for the vice president to reject electoral votes. Later that day, Dr. Eastman admitted his more palatable idea to have Vice President Pence delay rather than reject counting electors, and that rested on the same basic legal theory that he knew would not survive judicial scrutiny. Same theory. Dr. Eastman acknowledged he didn't think Kamala Harris should have the authority in 2024 and didn't think Al Gore should have had it in 2000. And he acknowledged that no small government conservative should think that was the case. Dr. Eastman also understood the gravity of his plan for democracy. He acknowledged, quote, you would just have the same party win continuously if the vice president had the authority to just declare the winner of every state. The evidence shows Dr. Eastman was well aware that his plan violated the Electoral Count Act. Dr. Eastman likely acted deceitfully and dishonestly each time he pushed the outcome-driven plan that he knew was unsupported by the law. And then overt acts in furtherance of the conspiracy, and you only need one from one of the participants. But President Trump and Dr. Eastman participated in numerous overt acts in furtherance of their shared plan. As detailed and linked above, President Trump's acts to strong-arm Vice President Pence into following the plan included meeting with and calling the vice president and berating him in a speech to thousands outside the Capitol. Dr. Eastman joined for one of those meetings, spent hours attempting to convince Vice President's counsel to support the plan, and gave his own speech at the Ellipse demanding the vice president stand up and enact his plan. Based on the evidence, the court finds that is more likely than not that President Trump and Eastman dishonestly conspired to obstruct the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021. All right. Now that the court has determined it's more likely than not that these two guys committed crimes, the court now determines whether any of those remaining 11 emails were in furtherance of those crimes. You know, that the court found evidence of above obstruction of an official proceeding and conspiracy to defraud the United States by attempting to persuade Pence to reject or delay electoral votes on January 6th. Quote, the crime fraud exception does not require a completed crime or fraud, but that the client have consulted the attorney in an effort to complete one, unquote. The exception applies even if the attorney does not participate in the criminal activity. And, quote, even if the communication turns out not to help and perhaps or even hinder the client's completion of a crime. An attorney's wrongdoing alone may pierce the privilege, regardless of the client's awareness or innocence. So, there we go. 9 of the 11 emails were discussions about ongoing active lawsuits, and the court says pursuing legal recourse doesn't advance any crimes. So these emails are protected. They don't fall under crime fraud exception. The 10th document is an email sent at 4:03 Mountain Standard Time, January 6th, during the resumption of the joint session of Congress after the attack on the Capitol. The email responding to a request to participate in Dr. Eastman's work on behalf of President Trump. While the email discusses Vice President Pence's refusal to reject or delay the electoral count, the email was not itself in furtherance of the plan and thus does not fall within the crime fraud exception. I like how the judge just tells us basically what's in the email, although that should have been what was put on his privilege log, which he sucked at writing. Now, the last email, this last one, is a chain, and I'm quoting here. The 11th document is a chain forwarding to Dr. Eastman a draft memo written for President Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani. The memo recommended Vice President Pence reject electors from contested states on January 6th. This may have been the first time members of President Trump's team transformed a legal interpretation of the Electoral Count Act into a day-by-day plan of action. The draft memo pushed a strategy that knowingly violated the Electoral Count Act, and Dr. Eastman's later memos closely track its analysis and proposal. The memo is both intimately related to and clearly advanced the plan to obstruct the joint session of Congress on January 6th. Because the memo likely furthered the crimes of obstruction of an official proceeding and conspiracy to defraud the United States, it is subject to the crime fraud exception, and the court orders it to be disclosed. Now, I know what you're saying, but AG, there were 7 considerations. You haven't talked about the substantial need for the documents yet. Well, the court addresses that one last, and they want to see if those 10 remaining emails fall into that category. Review of the 10 remaining documents shows that none are pivotal to the Select Committee's investigation. 9 of these include opinions and discussions about trial strategy in ongoing lawsuits. As discussed above, this litigation was a legitimate form of recourse and is not tied to the investigation's core purpose, which is to investigate and report upon facts, circumstances, and causes relating to the January 6, 2021 domestic terrorist attack upon the United States Capitol. The 10th email includes Dr. Eastman's thoughts on the evening of January 6th about potential future actions given Vice President Pence's refusal to reject or delay the Electoral Count Act. Cases that have found a compelling need involved situations where an attorney's bad faith was central to a claim or defense, making the attorney's opinions critical evidence. Although Dr. Eastman's thoughts in this email pertain to the January 6th Electoral Count, these thoughts are not analogously pivotal to the Select Committee's investigation. And then I love how the court does the thing we always do, which is put the shoe on the other foot, right? Would you want it this way if the Republicans were in charge? And the court says, the court reiterates its earlier statement that the Select Committee's investigation is weighty and urgent, but the court does not want to enable well-intentioned committees to circumvent work product protection by using broad and urgent mandates, as has occurred in our not-so-distant past. Unquote. So in conclusion, which I'm sure all of you scrolled to the very end of this document like I did. It says, Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history. Their campaign was not confined to the ivory tower. It was a coup in search of a legal theory. The plan spurred violent attacks on the seat of our nation's government, led to the deaths of several law enforcement officers, and deepened public distrust in our political process. More than a year after the attack on our Capitol, the public is still searching for accountability. This case cannot provide it. The court is tasked only with deciding a dispute over a handful of emails. This is not a criminal prosecution. This is not even a civil liability suit. At most, this case is a warning about the dangers of legal theories gone wrong, the powerful abusing public platforms, and desperation to win at all costs. If Dr. Eastman and President Trump's plan had worked, it would have permanently ended the peaceful transition of power, undermining American democracy and the Constitution. If the country does not commit to investigating and pursuing accountability for those responsible, the court fears January 6th will repeat itself. With this limited mandate, the court finds for the following 10 documents are privileged, and then it lists those 10 privileged documents. The court orders Dr. Eastman to disclose the other 101 documents to the House Select Committee. Signed, Judge Carter. And I've just received word that Eastman is not going to appeal this finding, which I don't have any other information on why or whether he intends to cooperate or what. But as soon as I know, I'll let you know. But he is not going to appeal this. I was going to have a whole discussion on what the appeal would look like. And we did go through that. And, you know, we'll tell you about it on tomorrow's cleanup on Aisle 45. But to me, this is the good news for the day. And so I'm not going to do any listener submitted good news today, but I'll pick it back up tomorrow. So you can send us your good news and confessions and corrections and pod pet photos and Whoopi stories and Easter Bunny pictures and Halloween photos. Anything you want to send us, you can do it at dailybeanspod.com and click on contact. Until tomorrow, please take care of yourselves, take care of each other, take care of your mental health, take care of the planet. Oh, and vote blue over Q. I've been AG, and them's the beans. The Daily Beans is written and executive produced by Allison Gill, with additional research and reporting by Dana Goldberg and Amy Carrero. Sound design and editing is by Desiree McFarlane, with art and web design by Joelle Reeder with Moxie Design Studios. Music for The Daily Beans is written and performed by They Might Be Giants, and the show is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, please visit MSWmedia.com.
MSW Media.